From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Today we're featuring two interviews from our program archive. Sometimes we look too intently at technology while failing to recognize human considerations. We'll take a look at how we can find personal stability in today's ever-changing technological world. We'll also examine how our behavior is being changed by technology and how those changes may be affecting our perception of reality. Tony Smith is founder of the Center for Transitional Leadership. His research examines how we can live productive lives during periods of great change. We'll explore personal journeys in the technology age. I'll later speak with Michael Heim. He's a classical philosopher as well as a lecturer in virtual reality. We'll discuss our ability to distinguish between virtual reality and reality. In Tony Smith's book, Parsifal's Briefcase, he begins with the thought, "We live in revolutionary times, and our lives are being altered in ways we cannot predict." I asked him what he meant.
I mean that the core values in the world are changing. The ideas that we guide our behaviors by are changing. Every major institution in the world is changing. The place money is made changes, the way it's distributed is changes, marketplaces have changed. And the reason it's a revolution for us individually is this is very personal and intrusive. I mean, everything, we need to understand that we need to change to live effectively in this world. We can no longer sit here and wait for everything else to change. We've got to change too.
Nothing earmarks the technology age so much as change.
Mm-hmm.
And not only change, but an increased rate of change, only adding a certain anxiety to viewing the future and how we're going to live. And it seems to me that you're saying that there's little point in seeking comfort from predictions of the future, but rather we get our personal stability by looking inward at ourselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We are the most magnificent tool for reading the way life is right now if we learn how to listen well to ourselves. You know, we're the best, talk about high tech, we're a fabulous technology, and we have learned not to listen to ourselves. So we can learn to sense what's going on. We can learn to hear the way the world is changing. We can learn to really know what's going on if we tap into ourselves. And we are an incredible mechanism. We're kind of like a gyroscope. We are very adaptive animals if we will learn to do that. And the adaptations that we make can be profound if we are able to be in touch with the changes that are going on around us that we might not expect or might not want to see, or that we might love but are afraid to actually say, boy, this is an opportunity.
American business is changing dramatically. What are the primary causes of this change?
Well, let's take the one that would be most congenial to people listening to this show, technology. Technology changes almost everything. It changes things. The obvious things it changes are the way we do certain things, and we can do a lot more than we could before. It also changes the hierarchy inside an organization. People who can use technology suddenly become important, where they might not have been before. The power structure is changed. It presents a challenge to any culture. Now, culture is very powerful. So I have seen people. I have a friend who's a consultant, and he went into a major brokerage house. And he brought in some fabulous new technology that would let the people there do their work in half the time. A year later, they went back and discovered that it was taking just as long to do the work because there was a culture inside these people that said it takes this long. So, you know, the human interaction needs to change with the technology, and we're up to it if we will learn how to really sense what's new.
You named your book Parsifal's Briefcase. Tell us the legend of Parsifal and the reason for the name.
Parsifal was a medieval knight. There are many versions of this story. I like the German version best because it really stresses this point. We're all in a dark wood, as all mythic heroes are. We're surrounded by beasts and confusion, and our job is to find our own path, to something meaningful. And in his case, he's looking for the Holy Grail, which is simply the great healing device. When people are in the presence of the Grail, they're authentic, they know their own mind, they can make connection with other people, and they can get something done. What struck me about that is most of us, I think, spend our time now not being sure what we want to get done, what we ought to do next, if we did know what we want to get done, how we want to feel, how we think. And it tells about the journey that heroes have always taken. It says, you're going to spend most of your time face down in the mud. That's very reassuring to me and to most of my clients. It says, you can come up with great plans and strategies, but until you know your own mind and spirit, nothing significant is going to happen. So you learn to really embrace yourself and reality. Finally, Parzival at the end learns that he has got to ask a question. He doesn't have to know the answer to everything. He's got to ask a question. And in this case, the question is, what ails you? He's got to go to the Grail King and ask with compassion, what ails you? Think about it. If we could learn to ask that question of ourselves and those we work with compassionately rather than as an accusation, what happens then is we all learn how to work together in a creative way. We see the world new. We're in discovery. That's how new worlds are built.
When an organization is changing, independent of the reason, because the markets have changed and it's an adverse effect, their sales are growing out of sight because they're onto something here, it doesn't matter. They're changing. What are the typical scenarios under which organizations change, and what are those problems?
Oh, that's a great question. We could talk about that for about 4 years. the scenarios are, you know, first of all, changes usually come hot and heavy before we recognize them. And one of my goals would get us to be able to recognize them real quickly and respond. But as you indicated, the marketplace is changing, consumer behavior is changing, needs are changing more quickly than organizations can possibly work to meet them. What happens is this. Inside organizations, people begin to be frightened. They begin to lose trust. The one characteristic that has many manifestations is we all go into isolation. Personally, we kind of get frightened and we start watching things and we get a little cynical. People find it harder to work together effectively. The people at the top are very interesting. When I get people at the top of organizations talking to me in private, they will say, you know, I don't know what's going on. Now, I think that's a great statement for a leader to make right now. He needs to be careful, he or she, who they make that to. But it's appropriate not to know what's going on right now. None of us could possibly know. You know, the rules of the game, the new rules of the game haven't been written yet. And so there's a lot of, I talk a lot in a book, and it's detailed, and so it's hard to do it in an interview, but there's just an awful lot of people getting isolated, getting frightened, listening to their own internal voices that say, don't trust a thing. And I'm saying, let's try it just the other way. Let's try to get less cynical. Let's move out of isolation. Let's get in touch with what we feel and what other people feel. Learn to imagine again, learn to believe again. And that's actually a very realistic and practical path out of this.
I'm struck with an image you were saying earlier about being in a gyro and things are moving. I remember getting a tip from an old salt once that saved my skin from seasickness when I was out on a boat. I was on a lot of boats for a while, not feeling good. And he said, just stand there and let the boat move around you. And as soon as that happened, I was fine. So now I'm fine on boats, but I kept trying to move with the boat. So in a sense, this sense of where you are, letting the world move around you, might be some key.
I'm gonna use that story, if you don't mind. That's perfect. It is a perfect description. Absolutely. Absolutely. Think about what that implies. It implies, first of all, that you would just as soon be stable as because one of the things that happens is when things are going badly, a lot of times we say, it's horrible. There's nothing I can do about it. Oh, my goodness. And without realizing it, we almost start dramatizing how bad it is. So the first thing that this old salt was advising you is, do you want to not get buffeted around? And you said, sure, I assume. Okay, then you develop things called sea legs. It's perfect. And if you learn to develop a way of being at home with the changing rhythms, rather than fighting them every second, and you will do that if you get a little bit of confidence that there's something inside you that's not going to change, then remarkable results can occur.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. My guest today is Tony Smith, and he's the author of Parzival's Briefcase, Six Practices, and a New Philosophy for Healthy Organizational Change. You describe corporate culture as bringing order to chaos. The computer company, software, hardware, technology company is a fairly recent phenomenon, only, you know, in the last few decades. Is there a difference in the corporate culture of technology companies?
There has been a huge difference in that technology and that culture. It has tended to be based on discovery, which is pretty exciting. And most organizations should be based on a sense of understanding that what is in the stage of becoming could be very real. So you couldn't start out describing a computer to people and saying, "Do you want one?" You know, because people would say, "I don't know what you're talking about. I'm busy." So you need to create something, and then at the same time as you're creating it, you need to sell it and keep creating it and keep changing it. There is a bigger understanding of the need for change, and people in these organizations tend to be either well educated or wildly curious, which create a different kind of a culture. On the other hand, as these organizations get a little older, they're beginning to experience some of the troubles that all organizations have. And they're getting more like other organizations. So my friends who work in the Silicon Valley, for example, are beginning to describe to me the same kinds of stresses and the same kinds of problems and challenges that occur in any organization where people are trying to get something done in a very changing world, and they don't quite know what to do.
When I talk to some people, I will frequently hear, "This is not the way it's done. Let's find somebody successful and copy it." And I never heard this when I worked at NASA. You know, we never did anything that had been done before. So, I mean, those words just weren't relevant. Is there a reluctance to create? Is that a problem in today's climate?
Sure, there is. Absolutely. That is one of the biggest fears that people have right now. Creating is a matter of taking huge risks. And it often means financial risks. Right now, people, if you play the wrong side of that risk, you may be out of work, you may be out of, you know, maybe the kids aren't going to have medical benefits. This is very serious stuff. A lot of technology companies have succeeded so far in keeping risk and taking a chance as part of the culture. As things get difficult, that is being lost in many of them. And that is one of the things that we need to protect at all costs.
Technology businesses are under constant pressure to create and innovate. Not only are their markets changing, but the shelf life of their products is limited, and the innovations of their competitors can literally make their businesses go away with a single product announcement. Are technology companies, by definition, always organizations in transition?
Yes, they are. They're always organizations in transition, and there are particular rules that apply to those organizations a little bit more than others. I would say that any significant organization today is in transition. Technology companies in particular, they are absolutely able to take advantage of a transitional period better than most organizations. They don't have to fight quite the same bureaucratic buildup. They have other problems, though, and that, again, sometimes what happens is the competition and the frightening nature of it can cause people to clamp down and close down. And while they talk a story of change and discovery, their behavior is not the same as their talk. And so on the one hand, you're getting urged to develop new things. On the other hand, you're afraid that your company isn't doing it very well right now. And you don't quite know what to do. And I know a number of people who are working hard and preparing their resumes. So it's, and I would have to say that is a natural thing right now. One of the things I like about the hero's journey concept and why I use Parzival is that confusion and that the two or three forces digging at you at once, and you're being forced to answer unfair riddles, and beasts are challenging you. In the hero's journey, you say, "Yeah, that's about a day. That's what happens every day. Yeah, that's natural. We need to understand that." So I think technology companies are coming into a new phase where it's not so rosy automatically anymore. And what I would like people to hear in those organizations is that is a natural part of this journey. It doesn't necessarily mean that things have gone bad.
One practice which you enjoin people to do is to discover your vision. What makes up a vision, and how long-term can that vision be when these lives are in so much flux?
The vision I'm speaking of refers to that core sense of yourself that it's that gyroscope that keeps your sea legs going when things are changing. So I would say this, a vision is a very deep understanding of what what we are in the world and what we want to get done. It is only provisionally something that we can understand in words at any given moment. So when I talk about understand your vision, I don't mean it in a simple-minded way of like, go out this weekend and get a vision and put it on the wall and that's that. I mean, learn the practice of listening deeply to yourself as you interact with life daily. I want this to be a practical thing for people. And learn what you love, what you care for, what you'll fight for. Learn what you find yourself doing anyway. And listen and notice that and begin to consciously follow that path. And I think that is going to be, and a vision that you can know will change over time. Absolutely. And you, if you were to keep track of it every day and you were a journalist after 20 years, you could look back and say, I see the pattern. It was the same thing, but it manifested itself differently.
I was interested in one exercise you had in the book where you projected that you were 3 years from now and you said all the wonderful things that had happened to you in the last 3 years and you kind of refined it and you went on and on. And then finally it says, now tell what were your stumbling blocks, your obstacles along the way? And it was great. It was like a flip of the cards. It's like, I can tell you exactly what I had problems with. It's an interesting exercise.
Well, you know, people love doing this, too. And what happens is, I just did this with some community leaders last week. And people were discovering that what really moved them, what they wanted to tell people that they had succeeded at, wasn't always what they thought. Sometimes it was, boy, my family is really stable. You know, the kids are feeling great. I'm happy. Or it was a slightly different version than they had thought. What's key to that exercise that's also key to vision is learn to listen to what you're really saying, not what you think you're supposed to say. I mean, just that alone is important because every time we do what we think we're supposed to do, we don't do it well. And we have got such resistance. And also, when it's something you care about and these stumbling blocks appear, if you really care about it, you learn to get flexible, you learn to get very sensible, you learn to get very strategic. Whereas if it's something you don't really want, you just keep running, you keep saying, oh no, I'm overwhelmed, I can't get this done.
My guest today is Tony Smith. He is a business consultant and co-founded the Center for Transitional Leadership. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. You describe false roadmaps, such as your career defines who you are and hard work and talent will overcome all obstacles. What are these false roadmaps and why won't they work?
These false roadmaps are kind of the everyday advice we get in life, and it's the stuff that people learn in business school. It's the way the culture has of directing us to shutting up and paying attention and doing what we're supposed to do. And there's value in that. It's important that we learn to be socialized. I think people need to learn a different, deeper version of those so that they understand that if the roadmap that you have in you that you may not even realize, but, you know, deep down inside, you think, well, if things aren't going well, it's my fault because I didn't work hard enough or I didn't plan well enough. And maybe you didn't. But the fact of the matter is all of this self-blame is very counterproductive. It's not going to help you straighten out and do things well. So that you got to get rid of the judgment. You got to get rid of the simple-mindedness of these false roadmaps and understand things in a deeper, more complex way. Because if you understand the deeper way, that's where your real power and your real abilities to do extraordinary things is going to come to the fore.
When I was reading your Legend of Parsifal, I was interested in that he failed a whole lot.
Yeah.
In fact, the harder he tried, the worse it got.
Yeah.
And he wasn't successful until somehow he, I don't know, took his foot off the throttle.
That's right.
That's the wrong image, but
It'll work.
Hand off the throttle.
This again relates to technology. Anyone who has developed technology knows that you spend most of your time discovering what didn't work. And that's not defined as horrible. That's defined as the scientific process. And what you do when it doesn't work is if you can stand back and look, you say, okay, here's what needs to be modified. Here's what didn't work. And you calmly work toward what it does. If, as a scientist, every time something didn't work, you stopped and said, oh, my God, I'm a horrible human being. I'm a disgusting wretch. No wonder it didn't work. And you go on and on and on and on. Not only would you never discover anything, but no one would work with you anymore. So we need to lighten up a little bit and begin to follow that path. And the hero always, as I said earlier, finally begins to find the answers through calmly coming to know himself or herself, finally listening deeply.
When you say create knowledge-based relationships, sort of like a techno term together with a human term, what does that mean?
I'm glad you asked. A lot of people don't get to that. Knowledge-based relationships to me means this. It goes back thousands of years to Plato, who said, self-knowledge is the most important thing we can work on in life. If we know ourselves, we know the world. And knowledge is a matter of breaking through all of the confusions around us and all of the mistakes and all of the socialization that doesn't work and listening to what we've always known. And we need to form relationships, I'm saying, based on the search for knowledge. So as you and I talk, if we have a knowledge-based relationship, I'm in it because I want to figure out who I really am and what the world's really like. I'm not trying to convince you of something. I'm not trying to be right about something. I'm not trying, some emotional game, and neither are you. As we talk, we're both exploring like mad, and we have the attitude of scientists, and we eventually are going to help each other really fly in whatever direction we need to, and this is back to find your own path. So my goal will be to find my path through an interaction with you, and I want to assist you in that, and you want to assist me. And that's like the scientific process. Together, we're going to discover what works.
Along those lines, I was interested when I read in the book about cautioning you to find out what someone is willing to listen to. I spent a lot of time in my life saying, how do I get this person to understand where I'm coming from? It may mean that they're not ready to listen to you at all, but that was sort of a different key. It kind of put it in another direction for me.
Yes, and finding out what people are willing to listen to doesn't mean that you only tell them what they already believe or that you're just kind of playing a little game. It means that you are deeply listening and you begin a discussion or a conversation with your own discovery and with actually deeply interacting with that other person. You got to get the barriers away. Now, this is a lot more difficult than it sounds. The woman I do a lot of my work with, Kelly Poulos, is a master at this, and I watch her because it's very hard for me. And she knows what she wants to get done. She has a vision for what she wants in a conversation, and she cares about it so much that being right or listening to her own voice is not interesting to her. It's more important to her to actually create a connection and to see together where people could go to discover how to do something because she's so committed to something happening. And if that means throwing out some way she had of saying things or even a way she had of believing things in the interest of something more exciting or more real, she moves to that right away. So that's what I mean by that. That's a very difficult and wonderful practice to begin to learn.
What are the characteristics of people working in transitional organizations? Now, I'm asking this slightly differently. How many times have you, been at a party and you turn to someone, especially out here in California, in Silicon Valley, and you say, boy, I just saw where your stock's going through the roof and you got this new product coming out. And you say, how's it going over there? And the first answer is, great. And then they go, boy, this person's driving me crazy and I can't believe that they let this person act this way over here. Why is that? What are we talking about?
Transitional companies are companies that they're in a particular state, and this state is one where they're headed is not something that people know for sure. I saw a very powerful president of a Silicon Valley company recently give a speech, and basically what he said to people was, we're having some trouble in the marketplace. Here is exactly where the trouble is. He was speaking to well-educated, well-informed people. He couldn't pull the wool over their eyes at all. And he said, I am not going to ask for your loyalty to continue based on the certainty that we're going to continue to succeed. I am asking for your loyalty based on the fact that we are very bright, we are very committed, we're working real hard. Here is the process we're using, and here are the people we've got involved. We think we've got a good shot at it. So the people in a transitional company are going to need to learn to look to the process and make valuations of it rather than the certainty of success, because there is no such thing now. And they're going to have to learn, basically personally, to develop the characteristics that keep them on a path. And the second thing is they're going to have to learn how to form Real Complex Networks of Relationships. There was a wonderful article in the Harvard Business Review a couple of years ago by the editor at that time, Rosa Beth Kantor, and she's saying managers are reinventing their job every day. They're having to form complex alliances with many people. People in transition organizations will notice that they have to be very, very adept at that. And you're changing the nature of your work and your conversation as you talk to different kinds of people. You need to learn to like it. And that's one of the reasons you need to learn where you are and what you feel, because that's going to be the one thing that's constant in all those relationships.
We started out this interview talking about value changes. Values and business don't usually fit in the same sentence.
Yeah.
Are there values in the corporate culture, in the organization culture that's changing now?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the core values that survive over time are the deepest human values. They are the concepts and the ideas that keep people moving, keep them flexible, and keep institutions from getting brittle and breaking up. And those values basically are the things that people can, everyone has in them at some place, which is, what do I care about in this life? What really matters? And in business, it means, am I developing a product or a service that's genuinely needed? And is there integrity to this process? And I wouldn't want people to get too crazy about this, because if you get to be a fascist with these questions, you'll never leave your bedroom. I mean, you know, it's like the world is not pure enough for me. Well, the world is doing what the world is doing, and we don't want to be silly about it. But there are these values, and so they are changing, and the way a company may manifest these values or seem to be going after them will change. And people need to be very, very alert. And that's why these kind of mythological questions are crucial. At a time like this, the question, what ails you, that Parzival asked in the year 1208, is a great question right now. So what ails the economy? What ails my company? What ails my manager? And what ails me? And the key is, can you ask that question compassionately? Or is it, hey, what's wrong with you anyway? And you've already got a judgment that's so thick that nothing could break through it. If you can develop that ability, you can be among the first people to articulate the new values that are going to keep your organization in alignment with the needs that are beginning to emerge in the world. And I think getting yourself and your organization in alignment with the way the world is becoming is the real trick right now. And that's where human values actually help rather than hinder. So it's what are the values that people are beginning to feel the need for right now? And how can we relate to that in a way that's genuine? What can we actually serve?
And it's not, here are the particular ones. Tony has a list. It's that they will be changing.
Yes.
We need to be open to what they are.
Thank you for saying that. Absolutely. I really think a list of 16 things that, you know, are going to change the world by Thursday without inconveniencing you don't work. So actually, it is find your own path. We need to get together and really discover those ourselves.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us.
I've enjoyed it a lot.
My guest today has been Tony Smith. He is the author of Parzival's Briefcase, published by Chronicle Books. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. While we're all waiting for the technology of virtual reality to actually materialize, classical philosopher Michael Heim has begun to examine the metaphysics of virtual reality. I asked him what that meant, the metaphysics of virtual reality.
What metaphysics has meant traditionally has been about the invisible, that is, the things in life that we don't quite see clearly, but are big, overriding facts about what we're doing, the background of our lives. By that, I mean the metaphysics of virtual reality has to do with that invisible dimension where our ATM money is stored, where the phone conversations take place, where we are when we're talking on the telephone long distance, our disembodied state. Uh-huh. In some sense, that is an invisible realm that increases in its depth and pervasiveness day by day. So metaphysics traditionally has been about the big issues, the biggest issues, about what's real, and about the things that we can't see directly in the physical world. So it's metaphysics. It's beyond the physical world that we directly see.
As you're saying this, I think about how many times I've been in a movie and I've been transported, or I'm in a book and it's like I'm in another place, or I'm driving along. This scares me because I kind of look up and 15 miles have gone by and I don't know where I've been. But that may be why virtual reality and those technologies actually work.
This is what I call being elsewhere. I think it's a new category we have to think of very seriously in terms of our history, in terms of our philosophical history and evolution as a species. We've extended ourselves increasingly, especially the last 300 years. We've had very definite plans about how to extend our presence. So this notion of presence and being elsewhere are what it's all about. I think that virtual reality technology is, in some ways, the hardware support that we've always dreamed of when we read novels, when we watch films. It's a new kind of hardware that enables us to define our presence in a different way, in a very, very extended way.
You talk about how what we write is different simply because we write it, say, on a word processor. And you quote Gore Vidal. You say the word processor is erasing literature. What are you saying?
What I'm saying is that publishers and even readers as well can learn to perceive word-processed writing from other kinds of writing, because the writer has undergone a different kind of thinking and writing and editing process when the writer uses a word-processing computer technology. And I've heard writers again and again say how their writing has changed in different ways as they learn to use the word processor. We are at the point now, we're at the transition point in history, where we are seeing, we have experienced the move from a non-computerized literature to a literature that now produces 80% of our written English in digital form. And we're going to see all the texts of our civilization now being stored on computer very shortly. So this is a sea change, a quantum change that will lead to a qualitative difference in how we think of language, how we experience language. I recall, I think it was Donald Regan in 1983 saying on television that don't worry about this particular law we're working on because it was written on a word processor. It can always be changed. So this whole sense, the malleability, the ephemerality, the flimsiness, you might say, of the written word. We've always said, I want to get it on paper, by which we mean something definite, something fixed, something that has credibility, something we believe in. But the word processor is introducing another approach to language, making it much more powerfully manipulable, but at the same time making it less set into resistant materials.
Is there a difference in what we write because we're writing at a word processor?
I think it's very difficult to analyze things on the long range using a form content distinction. That is, in the short range, we can see, okay, well, my content is the same. I'm writing the very same things that I'm doing when I'm writing on paper. And some people even started out using the word processor by writing it out by hand first and then entering it in later on a keyboard, just because they felt more secure in that old way. Now, people gradually, you'll notice, are shifting over and doing just their writing increasingly just on the computer. So I think it takes decades, maybe a whole generation, before you've got a really profound difference in the way people actually operate, where the form-content distinction is no longer applicable. So in other words, that what we write will be very much connected with the kind of instruments we're using when we write. And I think as we see electronic mail having a bigger influence on our population in terms of how they communicate with other people in written terms, and I think how they think about other human relationships when they relate to each other using email, I think we're going to see how difficult it is to continue saying, well, I'm writing the same way and I'm thinking the same way as I did before. Because the changes are subtle, gradual, but over a period of time, they become, I think, serious and profound.
Similarly, you note that the way in which we search databases limits what we find in our searching. Expand on that.
Well, it's like every question poses the parameters for an answer, for a possible answer. And sometimes the only way you can really answer someone is by rejecting the question. But mostly a question, the way we put a question, influences the possible answers we can get. And even more so now when we have a human that is really an augmented intelligence, that is a human-computer symbiotically connected. In that situation, the question, the way the question is posed, is not simply determined by the human interrogator, but it's also, you might say, supercharged by the computer's powers, but also therefore limited by the software that the computer introduces into the whole questioning process. So part of my book, The Metaphysics of Virtual Reality, is to look at things like Boolean searches and see how, in fact, when we do a search, when we treat texts as electronic data, the way our mind thinks about what we could find is shifted by the software, limited by the software that we use. Not only limited, but also, in some ways, of course, boosted. But every software writer also is trying to prescribe for us what they would like to have us think, or how they would like to have us think.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Michael Heim. He is a classical philosopher as well as a nationally recognized lecturer in virtual reality. You talk about musing. I was reminded in the 1960s that IBM put a sign in everyone's office which said, think. So it might be interesting to replace all those signs with ones that say, muse. What do you mean by musing, and how does that relate to the use of technology?
Well, if you think about the automobile as a great way to get around and a great way to go places and move yourself through space, it's a very positive phenomenon. At the same time, the automobile changes the culture, and it changes our whole relationship to movement and to the places that we go to. It changes the places we go to. It's not a hike in the countryside. I want to contrast the way that we think using, let's say, database searching and software to do our help to boost our thinking and augment our thinking. I think of that more as the freeway, as a way we can get to places very fast with great power, better than any other kind of text manipulation, from certainly not the scrolls and not chiseling in stone and not printing press. It's a new dimension of relating to writing. But at the same time, I think there's something we have to balance in our relationship to technology. My work with Taoism, particularly the Taoist Chinese tradition, tells me that there's something in us that it gives us energy in our thought processes. I call that musing, for another want of a better word maybe, but it goes back to the ancient Greeks, the idea of the musoi, the daughters of memory, the graces who brought charm and who brought magic into our thought process. That is, there's a freedom. Where do our thoughts come from? They emerge in sometimes surprising ways, especially when we're being creative, or when we're conducting a conversation. We don't know where they come from, for that matter. But there is this aspect that we, I think, are endangering with the freeways of the computer. That is, we might be able to get through our information and through our literature much more powerfully, with greater control and with greater network capacity than ever before in human history. But at the same time, we have to be careful that our evolution doesn't overextend us to the point where our ability to think attenuates into becoming simply an information processing peripheral. And I would like to suggest that we view our thinking as more fundamentally a wandering of the mind, a relaxed musing of the mind, like when we browse through books. And I think the book is not only an instrument for linear thinking, because it goes page by page, line by line, word by word, but even more so, we've come to use the book as a tool for musing when we browse in libraries, browse in bookstores. I think that capacity of the mind is very important, that we don't lose that on computers. I think computers can do things more powerfully, but they can shape and they can gear our thinking to a more tight, a more linear way of approaching things, more efficient, more productive in some sense. But I think in the long run, the more productive way is also the way that's the most human, the most natural for us. And I think musing is more fundamental than thinking. And thinking is merely one kind of musing.
The German philosopher Martin Heidegger saw technology as the root evil of the 20th century, while more recently Marshall McLuhan feared some aspects of technology. What were their fears?
Well, of course, Heidegger was speaking from an experience that he began seeing technology as a fundamental shaping factor in the 20th century. In the 1930s, he saw it very strongly. And he saw, as in his view, that technology was what made Nazism possible, in the sense of a dictator who could command radio and mm-hmm. could use loudspeakers and could reach a population, a mass audience, for the first time in history. The dictator could directly address the masses. And, of course, Leni Riefenstahl could make the movies and could create a whole myth around him in a very short time. This was the power of technology, that you could mobilize a population, a total population, in a very short time towards a definite goal in a way that never could have been done in history with that kind of efficiency and expediency. So Heidegger, at the same time as he saw technology as our destiny, thought that it was at the root of some of our most profound tragedies. And McLuhan noticed also that, in fact, in one of his phrases, McLuhan referred to technology as a Luciferian development. But he tried to keep his public comments he tried to keep them neutral without tipping them into good or evil, because he thought, as he said, that his opinions would be like smog in the culture to cover our eyes from seeing and analyzing what is actually happening. If we take a good-bad position, we tend to be reacting in one way or another, either as complete utopians or dystopians. Rather than do that, I think the job today, the responsibility we have, is to look very soberly at what actually is happening and to continue ourselves as individuals to articulate our anxieties, our hopes, the specific changes we see as we live with the technology, and to connect with the technical people as much as possible to bring them our ideas and our thoughts. We have the base now, the infrastructure to do this with television, radio, fax, and computers, but the technicians have to be open, and the lay people have to take an interest. We need to become a cybernetic society, one that is self-regulating, one that is aware of what's happening and is responsible enough not to sit back passively and watch it, but rather to take charge to whatever extent we can in its steering, in its shaping.
In your book, you talk about the love affair which humans have with computers and with technology. What are you talking about?
Well, I see it all the time, and I'm sure there are many people who are listening who have seen their coworkers suddenly be transformed by a computer program or by a new installation of hardware, or maybe even someone who's found computers for the first time. There's a kind of eros, a kind of profound attraction, involvement, engagement, that I think defines not only ourselves today in the United States, but in fact becomes the global identity that we all have together, what we share. Rather than the working class as a material producer, or rather than any specific group asserting its rights, I think the new universal humanity is one that is a technological human being, with both the positive thrust of that as well as the dark side and the anxieties and the need to articulate potential futures of technology.
I have to say that when I first read this thing saying, oh, a love affair with computers, I said, well, that's crazy. You know, I work with computers all the time. And I remembered a time when I'd gotten out of graduate school and I'd taken like 8 weeks off. And about the seventh or eighth week, I was really missing a computer. I really, you know, it's like, gee, I really liked working on the computer. And it was about the only time that I went that long without a computer once I had known it. And I realized, well, gee, maybe there's a little more to this. If you would ask me to give up my computer today, I'll have to find something new to do with my life. all the various aspects have to do with that. And so there's some bond there.
Your phrase, what we do with our lives, that's exactly what I was talking about. That is, every civilization, you might say, sacrifices humans or human energy and human attention to something. The Egyptians built pyramids, the Middle Ages, cathedrals. I think the 20th century is not the time of shopping malls. They're not going to last. But rather, it's the computer civilization we're building.
My guest today is Michael Heim. He is author of the recent book, The Metaphysics of Virtual Reality. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Michael, what is cyberspace, and how does that relate to virtual reality?
Cyberspace is the all-encompassing electronic network that stores the information that makes the bank run, that makes most businesses function, that puts us together on the telephone lines. In other words, it's the electronic presence. When somebody picks up the phone and says, "Are you there? Are you here?" in a sense, they're asking, "Are we together?"
Mm-hmm.
Are we together? And when we're together, where are we? This is a space called cyberspace now. We have a name for this, thanks to William Gibson's neologism. And this dimension, this realm, has many specific manifestations, one of which is the alphabet. We can type in cyberspace. We can also talk in cyberspace. Now what's happening with virtual reality is that we can regain some of the integrated sensory experience that we have in the primary world outside of cyberspace. We can now, actually, and not as a whole civilization, but in small research labs, we can see the world, feel the world, hear the world at the same time that is computer generated. So we are not restricted to simply voice connection or to connection with a one-way passive television screen or simply to writing, typing the alphabet on electronic mail, but rather we can see things together, look at each other, and move things around, interact with that world, just as we can in the primary world. So cyberspace opens up, and one dimension of it is virtual reality. That is, experiences which are very much like our sensory life experience in our primary bodies.
Everyone understands about talking to people on the telephone, hearing people on the radio. Some people are driving in their cars right now. They're presumably doing very well, but they also are in another little place in their head listening to this conversation. Now, these are all old technologies. What are the new technologies? What are they going to be doing?
Well, there are different ways in which this technology is moving, and one of the ways recently that has caught a lot of attention is the one in which a headset is put on, let's say swimming goggles or a football helmet. It fits over the head and excludes the surrounding world. But instead of the surrounding world, stereoscopic lenses are put in front of the eyes, like little TV screens. And the eyes then perceive a three-dimensional environment, which is generated by a computer that is putting out those pictures. And if the ear also hears then also three-dimensional sound, placed sound, like it would in a good theater. So this kind of environment also usually requires some kind of a manual device, like a glove. You'd put on a fiber optic glove that would give the signals of your hand movements to the computer and would tell the computer what you're doing with your hand. It also tracks your head and tells the computer what you're doing with your head movement, where your head is moving. So that as you move your head and hands, the computer is updating constantly the screen in front of your eyes to show you what's happening in this world that you now feel you inhabit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very fundamental, basic, primitive type of cyberspace, that virtual reality that is now very much in development and is going to be reaching the games and the market for young people here in the next few months.
What is potentially dangerous about virtual reality?
Well, those things, of course, we cannot know for sure right now because these are things that the future will tell us. But we can try to extrapolate, and my own work is to extrapolate on very large canvases. That is, I like to think in terms of decades or half centuries and phases like that, because my area is philosophy and metaphysics. So my primary resources are very fundamental ideas, and those ideas take decades to work out. And so when I look at the fundamental ideas behind a technology, I only can do very long-range projections as to the good or bad that will come from it. Nevertheless, those projections are based on very fundamental things and fundamental flaws in the technology. Looking to the more short range, though, some of the things that are being worried about right now are, very simply, the optical kind of errors that are introduced in the stereoscopic viewing are of serious concern. There have been some research that indicates the convergence of the eyes is being forced in ways that are not very helpful for the human physiology. And you use this for any period of time, and you will start seeing things rather strange when you emerge, not to mention what your optometrist might think.
Yeah. So anyway, those muscles would be exercised in a far different way.
Exactly. Also, there's many problems with tracking, because if there's any kind of lag time, there's something called a simulator sickness that was familiar to pilots before, and there's something very much like that in the current virtual reality systems. There is a slight lag in movement and in update time.
Now, we're talking about virtual reality, but it's only going to work as well as it hooks into human reality. Now, what allows virtual reality to be human reality?
These are some of the questions I think that philosophers have to deal with, and deal with very, very aggressively and with considerable clarity. We have to try to look more closely at this, and it may not be something you can do in 2 minutes or 2 days or 2 years, but we have to look at the overlap between this cyberspace and our human reality. I'm talking the cyberspace of the telephones and the televisions and this whole connection. We still have to articulate what this is doing to our primary human existence. But if we look simply at the virtual reality technology as, let's say, a simulated world where we feel present in something that feels very comfortable and as attractive to us, as useful to us as the primary world, let's say we feel the powers of being in that virtual world, virtual environment, what are the ways in which we can create a reality check, a virtual reality check? Well, when I was thinking about this, I drew on Hannah Arendt, one of the great philosophers of our century, who in turn drew on some of Heidegger's ideas. And what she came up with was, in terms of political reality, she thought some of the features of our human existence are mortality, that is, that we are vulnerable as well, and also that we have a dimension of care. So those three things. We're mortal, which means we're also born into a family. We have what she calls natality. Mm-hmm. That is, we belong to a certain human group that is connected to us by blood. And this is not true of a cybernetic organism. And that dimension also shades over into this vulnerability or fragility of our human existence. That is, we can get hurt. And our primary bodies are fragile. They're one-time-only affairs. And they can also be damaged. And this is a dimension that can help us differentiate the virtual from the real. As we have to draw lines, I think, between virtual reality and primary reality by saying that virtual reality cannot be a place where we can be harmed. It is a place where we also recognize that mortality and natality, this being born and this dying, are belonging to the primary world. And that's a prerogative of the primary world, and that we do not use that way of thinking, that way of categorizing in the virtual world in order to keep them distinct and separate. And then finally, there is also this care that is distinctive to our human existence because we're fragile, because we're born, because we grew up in certain groups and so on. We understand love and care. We understand this human connection. And I think it's also connected to our primary bodies insofar as if we look at some of the ancient traditions, they talk about an energy, a ki or chi that pervades the universe and unifies everything. And I think there is something, you can actually verify it. If you study martial arts, you can see that there are ways in which we can notice things about human beings and physical bodies. We can notice when they're going to move before we actually see them move. We can sense things. There's a kind of sense in which we are connected to one another and to the universe as a cosmic being. And I think this connection is something we have to realize is there in primary reality and will not be there in virtual reality. So we have to keep these areas distinct and realize that virtual reality will not have these features and that these are treasures in our primary reality that we have to reinforce by reclaiming some of those traditions that assert mortality, natality, that see the preciousness and fragility of our human bodies, that also value other human beings for their feeling, for their fragility, and that we can care about. We say, take care. We should get very serious about that because in the virtual worlds, we may not have the same kind of feeling and it will be a different kind of world. And I think we have to keep that very clearly in mind.
Michael Heim is the author of The Metaphysics of Virtual Reality, published by Oxford University Press. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. And now here's Barry Evans with a perspective he calls As the Earth Turns.
Our planet, the Earth, rotates relative to an invisible grid created by the rest of the universe. You can literally see this rotation by watching a Foucault pendulum, many of which are installed in science museums and galleries all over the country. To understand how a Foucault pendulum works, imagine hanging a pendulum from a frame built over the North Pole in winter when it's continuously dark, and let it swing for a while. Overhead, the stars slowly rotate around the sky, taking nearly 24 hours to make a full circle. As you watch the stars, you can see the pendulum out of the corner of your eye. And here's the magic. It's moving around with the stars. The Earth rotates beneath it. Suspended from a point in space on the Earth's axis above the North Pole, where the effect of the spinning Earth is zero, the pendulum is guided in its motion by an invisible grid of gravity which fills space. The framework for this grid is defined by the universe as a whole, a fraction of which is perceived by us as visible stars overhead. And it's from this grid that the pendulum takes its orders. Foucault's pendulum works anywhere on Earth, although the period it takes to complete a full circle varies from nearly 24 hours at the pole to infinity at the equator. In San Francisco, for instance, it takes about 40 hours. In 1543, Nicholas Copernicus wrote from his deathbed to Pope Paul III, "I can easily believe, Holy Father, that when people read that I ascribe certain motions to the earth," he meant its spin on its axis and its orbit around the sun, "they will shout out that me and my theory should be rejected." Well, centuries were to pass before people could actually see Earth spin. By watching a pendulum that one Léon Foucault installed in the Church of Saint-Genève in Paris in 1850, Foucault used a 62-pound cannonball suspended from 200 feet of piano wire. There, observers could check for themselves that the pendulum swing was constantly and predictably veering clockwise. 300 years after his death, here was a visible demonstration of Copernicus's bold proposition: our planet really does spin.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.